are very pleased to have as our special guest this evening Ken Gonzalez Day, artist, writer, and associate professor at Scripps College. I'm sure some of you are familiar with his work and are very much looking forward to, as I am, to this discussion about his photographic work and his recent book, Lynching in the West, 1850 to 1935, which has recently been nominated for a 2006 Pulitzer Prize in History. Congratulations.
Keep the lights off, which is good. That way I can make sure you don't fall asleep. It is 7 o'clock. So to begin with, I made this lovely graphic to introduce us to the idea of what it is I'm talking about. As you might know, if you've seen a show upstairs, or if you haven't seen it yet, I'm not in it. So I'm trying to build a bridge conceptually for us. Even though it's a bridge, we're going to extend up to the museum. We're going to project it upward. And it's going to allow us, when we do see the show, if we haven't seen it yet, to contemplate the myriad ways that modernism might affect our image of the West. Here is our sort of historical beginnings. This is a postcard that was mass-produced, basically, turn of the century, 1910 to 1915. As you can see at the bottom of it, it says Der Wild West Show. And this is not a real lynching, this is a stage lynching, right? And there has been a great deal of writing already on the history of lynching photographs. Most of you are familiar with that, or have heard of that. Basically, the images of African Americans being lynched were produced into postcards and sold. Basically, after 1900, the largest number of them being produced from 1910 to 1930, and were circulated. And there have been exhibitions of that work and quite a bit of scholarship on that. So I'm not going to go there. What I'm really looking at is locally in California, how that history manifested itself here. Where do we have these images of the West? How do those images of the West impact our understanding of, or not impact our understanding of lynching nationwide? So this image tells us already from the beginning, and of course that I added in for a fun graphic for us. But basically you can see that they're dressed up as sort of frontiersmen, right? As sheriffs, they have guns, they have pistols. This is being basically performed for a German audience, right? So there's already an interest in, by the turn of the century, in this image of the Wild West. It's already an international image, it's not a local image, and I think that's one of the things to keep in mind when we think about the American West, right? That it's produced globally on some level. There's a little bit of a reference that I'm not going to read you, but in the book about Walter Benjamin or Benjamin, who writes about the arcades and the idea of the souvenir, right? And this is a postcard he could have seen. He probably walked past as it was sold in the arcades in Berlin, and yet his discussion really talks about class as opposed to race. So it's just a bunch of different references to sort of bring us into the idea of the photographic image and the social history. Also, I wanted to say in the beginning, if you have questions, just ask questions as we go. I'm able to talk and read and show you images and fill up lots of time, but I'd rather respond if you have specific questions, just call them out as we go. Overall, I wanted to give you just I promise this is the only textual PowerPoint slide, but I think it's important because it is a complicated project. One, I wanted to use legal executions to challenge the popular conception of the West as a lawless frontier. It's a very important point when we think about Western history. Two, correct the historical record by identifying the lynching of Latinos, Native Americans, Chinese blacks, Latinos, and whites in California. Three, consider the impact of photography on the history of lynching. Obviously, that's the lynching photograph. And four, look at racial formation in the American West. We will not be doing all those things tonight. Unless you want to. If you want the books, I can come back and we can go until late night. But I wanted to give you a scope of what my vision for it was and how I set out to, the kinds of questions I set out to answer for myself. Here is a postcard produced in 1904. And you can see it says Adios Amigos right here at the bottom, and it's of a legal execution. It's from Prescott, Arizona. It was mass-produced and printed in Brooklyn and sold nationally. The idea here, why I've included this, is just to give us an image of a legal execution in California or in the West. Here, 1904, it's also being produced as a postcard. It's being sold and distributed in the same way as the lynching images are. But what's different here is that we don't have a crowd, a leering crowd, right? One of the things that constitutes a legal execution is that it should not be available for public viewing. It's supposed to be held in a private area or close off from the public. So we see that even in Prescott, Arizona, they were able to manifest a barrier, right? So we often hear in the California Fellowship that there was no place that was private, there was no place it was done publicly because that was the way it had to be. And I just wanted to show an example that shows us very early on that there were lots of options available to them. We can also see that there's a stand here. We have a sheriff, we probably have a priest, we have a number of officials who are going to be there to administer the penalty. And lastly, and most importantly, we have a platform which regulates the degree of the fall. And for those that are not familiar, when one is hung, you're not suffocated, your neck is broken, and that causes you to die, right? And if you're lucky, it happens very, very quickly. It can happen as short as 8 to 15 seconds. If it's a proper height, proper distance, proper fall. If it's the wrong length, then a number of rather horrible things can happen. The person can be, if they don't fall far enough, then they'll just sort of suffocate, and this will cause them to have to be rehung several times. And far worse than that, if it's too far of a drop, then their head will fall off and be pulled off, and it's rather gruesome. I know it's sort of horrible to say, but this is the topic we're dealing with here. So the point of this is to lay out in the best of circumstances, how this legal method of execution functioned, and then we can begin to consider it's the opposite end of the other end of the spectrum. This is an early quote from an 1854 newspaper describing the lynching of two Mexican men in Mariposa County. And it says, their bodies are now swinging to the limb where they were executed and will probably continue to boast the wonder gaze of the public until time and decomposition shall allow them to fall to pieces. I put that out because this dates from before photography was available in California. And 1854, in reading that, boast the wonder gaze of the public until time and decomposition shall allow them to fall to pieces. Right, there is an invocation of the visual here, right? This idea that there is a spectacle to be seen, and that spectacle is what is being focused on in the journalism of the period. Later on, we'll see the photographs stand in for that, right? They begin to embody that desire for the spectacle. And here is a classic Western lynching of John Heath, Tombstone, Arizona, 1886. This was quite early. This was sold as a view card. This is before the postcard is invented. The view card was a slightly larger format and would be collected, but could not be sent in the post. And you can see here, of course, what I was drawn to, or I'm still drawn to, is the crowd. Their presence there and their relationship to the camera is something I'm going to read a little passage on as we get to that. But I wanted to give you a little bit of an overview. And then I want to read my first little section, if you don't mind, because I love it. I worked really hard on it. We can take a little sip of water. Yes, please come in. Yes.
What might these guys have done? What might their crimes have been?
Their crimes vary. In all the cases, the majority of them are accused of murder or perhaps some sort of violent crime. But since there was no trial, we don't know if they're guilty. We also don't know if they grabbed the right person. And there were also some cases where the person might have stolen there's one case in Los Angeles, which I'll show you an image of, where the guy had stolen a chicken. So they were definitely not all capital offenses, but many of them were. And oftentimes, they would actually be pulled out of the, they were being tried, they'd be pulled out of the, in one case, from the courthouse, as they were being tried in the middle of the trial. People went in, grabbed him, and drug him out to the tree. Most often, they were already being held. They were often already in local jail. And so it really was an intervention. And that's another part of this Western myth that we often don't think of. These guys were already in custody, and they're already undergoing a legal procedure. Any other questions before I read a little passage? I exited Union Station in downtown Los Angeles and began walking south. I was traveling to the intersection of Alameda and Aliso Streets, barely a block away. To get there, I'd have to take one of several streets that extended over the freeway. This particular stretch of freeway had been carved out of one of the oldest parts of the city when urban planners decided that running a multi-lane highway through a few blocks of crumbling adobe buildings could serve two purposes: lead visitors through town and shield them from the unsightly past. But like an old wound, it still scars the landscape, forming an artificial barrier between Los Angeles's raucous past and its sprawling present. 18-wheelers hummed and hissed their way through the slow traffic below me, modern-day woolly mammoths trapped in rush-hour tar pits. Once across the freeway, I realized that I was standing at the very intersection I'd been searching for. I walked in slow circles and squinted helplessly at the bleached gray asphalt, vaguely aware of how random my actions might appear to those passing by, but I could see no one. I knew he wouldn't be there. I'd gone to witness his absence, as I had done for 100 others in 100 places. What did I expect to see? The broken circle of blood-soaked dirt that would have formed beneath his feet as the wind pushed his body in slow circles? No, there was nothing to see, no clues to what had happened here. Perhaps it was the saccharine smell of hot tar, smoldering brake pads, and diesel fumes that was making me nauseous, but I had to leave. An ordinary case. It was just weeks before the great deluge after that would define the winter of 1861, 1862, a year when the Los Angeles River would overflow its banks and store owners like Mr. Meyer or the Hellman brothers would face ruin as adobe walls melted beneath torrential rains. On October 17th, Miss Leck, or Frau Leck, as she was sometimes called, was working in a small shop that she and her husband owned in downtown Los Angeles when she was brutally stabbed and robbed. According to one account, there were no witnesses. Another suggested that her young children may have been present in the store during the heinous crime. Word spread through the crowd that a suspect had been identified. He was rounded up and brought before the angry crowd. A rope was placed around his neck. One eyewitness detailed how the angry mob dragged the accused down Alameda Street, observing that by the time they turned onto Aliso Street, the loathsome creature had been stabbed so many times that he was nearly dead already. In spite of his rapidly declining health, he was strung up by the vigilantes just blocks from the sheriff's office. The newspaper summarized the popular sentiment surrounding the case when it wrote, quote, "A butchery such as he committed was enough to stir our citizens to call aloud for instant vengeance." This was no ordinary case. A helpless and feeble woman, a mother with two little children playing around her, is set upon by the devil in human form and mangled and mutilated until life is extinct for the purpose of gain. No death is too horrible for such a monster, and the yawning gates of hell open to receive him none too soon. Close quote. This particular monster was named Francisco Cota, and he was 15 years old. In uncovering the details of the case, I would learn that he was Mexican, he had been denied due process, that he was stabbed, dragged, and hanged with a rope by a group of European and Anglo-Americans that had chosen to take the law into their own hands. Afterwards, his body was left to hang on public display for an undisclosed period of time. If the boy was lucky, and there's no reason to believe that he was, his family members would have found his body in time to provide a proper burial. In considering the details of the case, I wondered if justice could really be served if the law was not. In Coda's case, all legal alternatives had been blatantly ignored. The 1861 claim that this had been, quote, no ordinary case, close quote, was ironic because, as the history of lynching makes clear, Coda's treatment by the enraged mob was nearly identical to the treatment received by thousands of other persons lynched across the nation. And then one last section. This book attempts to correct the historical record in one of these states and to reveal to the nation that, like the lynching of African Americans, Native Americans, Chinese, and Latinos of Mexican and Latin American descent were lynched in California. This book demonstrates that many of these public killings were guided by anti-immigration sentiments, the fear of miscegenation, a deep frustration with the judicial system, or in combination with white supremacy. Thus, the goal of this study is twofold. First, to provide a broader understanding of the transracial nature of lynching in the United States. And second, to consider those factors which may have contributed to the nearly complete erasure of this history from national consciousness. Yes?
Are only people of color lynched, or were there any Anglos that was lynched for whatever reason, and what was the percentage of if they were?
The percentage nationwide, the standard records on lynching were created by the Tuskegee Institute and also by the NAACP, and those records record approximately 5,000 cases of lynching in the United States, of which 1,400 are recorded as being Anglo, the rest being African American. That, and they're the ones who create really the established the anti-lynching movement and established the data that we still use. My data, which is extends sevenfold the NAACP records, shows that of the 352 cases in California, over two-thirds were persons of color. If we are willing to consider Latinos a race. And again, I argue today we're considered an ethnicity for those that aren't familiar with the census records. But historically, of course, in the 19th century, we were considered a race, which I argue and demonstrate. So combining Latino, Native American, Chinese, and African Americans all together, we get roughly a two-thirds ratio, which is almost identical parity with the national statistics. But we have a very different makeup. We also, just to keep in mind, the NAACP records begin in 1880, right, and go through 1968, the last lynching. I'm looking at 1850 to 1935, so I've turned the clock back, right? I've turned the clock back to before the Civil War, to before slaves were free, to before lynching had already taken on all of the meanings that we think of when we think of the racial violence connected with it, right? We're in a place where it's sort of the beginnings of America really trying to construct a pattern of racial violence, and stretching their wings on or the rope on those things.
But when does this actually become spectacle? When does it really shift to the photograph? You suggested in the introduction that at one point photographs were used in glorious spectacle.
Yeah, I argue that's why I gave that very first quote, that it was always a spectacle. That's 1854, and that I think that description of the wonder gaze, right, gives a very clear understanding that these people. As you're reading that newspaper article in your daily paper, having your coffee, eating your squirrel, or whatever they were eating back then, that you would have a sense of... You know, it's a heavy topic, so we gotta try to work with that, you know? It's still good history, it's just a heavy topic. But I'm really arguing that this idea of the spectacle is already well established by 1854, and I cite other cases in print. Then I also find a bunch of early drawings where, of course, they were reproduced or printed as billboards and various things that could be distributed in the 19th century.
Okay. I'm just curious, do you have examples of postcards that people sent and what they wrote on them?
I do. I don't have them with me here, but one that isn't that you can see, I think it's on my webpage, but it says, and just at the back, all it said was, and this is what he got. Mm-hmm. Like a classic. Others, and I'll show you an example coming up of the way the view cards were used. Often people would say, look at what was happening in this fun town I just visited, or something like that. They were often sold by the the, and you know, keep in mind, we're talking about artistic practices here. These are photographers that were also constructing these images and selling them. So I'm, you know, there's another element there, right? And they would often travel with them because you couldn't mail them. They would carry them around and sell them at different gatherings. Any other questions before, yeah?
What led you to this project?
What led to the project question? What led me to the project? The simple answer is, I started wanting to write a book on Latino portraiture in California from 1850 to 1900, and I still want to do that. And I spent a lot of time on it. I have lots and lots of work I did, and hundreds of images that I found. And as I was looking through the images, I came across, I'm sorry, I pulled it out of my PowerPoint at the last minute, I thought it would be too long. But I found this beautiful, absolutely gorgeous portrait taken in Los Angeles in 1885 of a young Latino man, turns out to be about 21 years old, in a beautiful corduroy jacket with a beautiful corduroy vest and a lovely cravat, and beautifully posed on a bearskin rug. And I thought, this is a beautiful image. This belongs in the history books. This belongs in the history of photo books. And when I flipped it over, it said, last man hanged in Los Angeles. Last man hanged in Los Angeles. What does that mean? I mean, does that mean he was legally executed? Does that mean he was lynched? Does that mean, I didn't know what that meant. So that was one of the, where I got this idea of this question of that. Then I came across a second portrait, also equally beautiful, equally well posed, equally staged. And this was someone that was also publicly executed legally. The photographs were taken and sold for a year prior to the actual execution, so that when the time came, there actually were over 8,000 people in attendance, and this is in 1881. So again, all of this predates, when we think of Southern lynchings, this predates it by a good 20, 30 years. So really, it shows us a different perspective, or a different piece of the puzzle. Yes?
I hear you speaking about men that were lynched. Percentage of women, or do you cover, were any women lynched as well, and do you have a percentage of how many women were lynched?
The percentage I have is I don't know how to break it down to percentage. It was only one. her name was Josefa, and she was a Mexican woman who lived in Downsville, which is a small small town north of Sacramento. It was the very first 4th of July in the state's history. People were celebrating. They stayed up all night drinking and having a good old time. They were going from cabin to cabin, from tent to tent, and about sometime after midnight, four or five men decided to visit her in her room. And one of the guys, the main guy, was said to have been over 6 foot tall, a rather large, you know, very, I guess, giant guy from Ireland or something. And he goes into her room, or cabin or tent, it's unspecified, and spends some time there with his friends. Again, it's unspecified. He leaves. He comes back about 5 in the morning before the sun has come up, and he comes to her door and says, in theory, he's there to apologize, but somewhere along the way he calls her a puta, a whore, in her own language, and she says, you walk into my home, I'm going to stab you. And I think you can imagine he said, no Mexican woman's going to tell me this or that. He walks in, she stabs him, he drops dead within about 8 minutes. They come back to get her at about 15 minutes, and she's up on the bridge, the town bridge, and there's various examinations. Someone claims that she might be pregnant, so they have to investigate, and they determine that she isn't. And they then, in sort of what we call sort of vigilante style or vigilance committee, they claim to give her a prosecution and a defense lawyer. But they roll her defense guy down the hill on a barrel, according to the description. She says, you know, she says, if this happened again, I would do it happily again. She throws her hair back. Makes, you know, this, it's the 19th century. This is what comes down to us from the newspaper accounts. But she basically looks him in the face and says, I would do it again, right? And so we have a case where somebody's clearly guilty. She committed murder, right? But we also have a situation where we can pretty, I think, fairly conclude that no Anglo woman in a gold rush mining town of 1850s would have been lynched, and certainly over killing some guy who came into her private space in the middle of the night several times. And then there's other more horrible stories connected to that. I'm getting the moving along thing. Another short little section. So to explain my project, so that gives us a little overview on the history of lynching a little bit for the West, and I want to explain a little bit about my own artistic project and where I enter into this equation. As a practicing artist, a photographer, and an avid researcher, I set out to travel to and photograph as many of the sites as I could. I photographed oak trees in rustic and urban settings, in strip malls, and amidst tract housing. Over the past 5 years, I have retraced the steps of the lynch mob and vigilance committees, and these photographs have become an irrefutable record of my journey. The most beautiful landscape is undone. Sometimes a natural landmark or the mention of a street name guides me, but often I have no way of knowing whether I was photographing the exact site or not. In my own journey, the photographs have come to symbolize points of resistance in a vast landscape, both physical and historical, over which I have no control. A solitary figure on a solitary journey, I have documented the empty space that lies between the historically unseen body of the lynch victim and my own unseen body. Standing on the side of the road, tucked beneath an old-fashioned black hood that covers my camera's ground glass, cars slow and people stop to ask what I am doing. What can I tell them? Once out of sight, I gaze into the haunted shade and try to remember the names of those who died, if known. I also try to remember the names of their victims. In visiting the many different locations and regions of the state, I have been able to see this history with new eyes. Sleeping at a roadside motel or camped in some pristine wilderness, I can sometimes understand how isolated and threatened these small communities must have felt. In the Gold Rush town of Columbia, now preserved as a state park, travelers can wander down Main Street or sit in the cool dampness of the old jail cell. There's a courtroom wedged in a long, narrow room a few short blocks from both the jail and the bar. Scarcely wider than a modern hallway, it is filled with small chairs. One begins to understand the degree of isolation that the people in these communities must have felt as they crowded in into the courtroom, huddled side by side to pass judgment on murderers and thieves in between rounds of whiskey at the saloon. Part pilgrimage and part memorial, my work has taken me to hundreds of California's lynch sites, and no matter how pristine or developed these sites may be, my experience of the landscape has been forever transformed. Here are some of the images. This is I just went there on Monday, and I just got back. They claim that this one had, they're not included in the book because I only included ones I could document with multiple sources, but the local lore says that each time that they lynch someone, they cut the branch off, and they say that there were probably 6 to 10 cases at this particular tree.
They're mostly oak trees.
Oak trees were a favorite of lynch mobs for a number of reasons. One, because they're indigenous to California, or to many parts of California, and even Los Angeles had many, though many of them have been removed. Thousand Oaks, they actually were. Yeah. There's still a few left. One of the things they liked about them was, of course, they had all these wonderful low-hanging branches that were very, very easy to get access to. You could have several rounds of whiskey and still get the rope over the branch, right? Oftentimes, they were not very high. No, they were not technically tall enough. There's also, they're also endangered in California. They're dying of sudden oak death. And so, I guess it's last year that over 10,000 have died. And so, you can see that they're developing all around them, of course. They're protected by state law. You're not allowed to cut them down. But for those that are not horticulturalists, this tree is pretty much dead. I mean, it will be dead. The sprinklers that are going to be on these plants will eventually cause the roots to dry and fall over. So even though they're not blatantly chopping it down, it will probably go. And they may not have meant to. I'm not saying they were maybe trying to kill the trees, but it's just negligence. A lot of people don't know how to take care of native species. They're also very delicate. They have very delicate immune systems. So we carry a lot of bacteria from the plants we buy at Home Depot. All these microbes and bacteria from other continents come to this continent and also destroy the native species. And these are all shot with a technical thing. They're all shot with a Deerdorf 8x10 camera, which is a very old-fashioned landscape camera used by the likes of Ansel Adams and Weston. So when we're thinking about this idea of, let's say, modernism in the Western landscape, I mean, I would argue that these are trying to undermine the fantasy of racial neutrality, of a race-free landscape that Ansel Adams and Weston construct, right? So the paradigm of the California landscape is the paradigm of a race-free landscape, right? And so by inserting, even very minimally, through conceptual framing, the idea of racial, or racial questioning or racial formation into this landscape, I'm trying to, you know, alter it on some level. So on the one hand, they are beautiful, and this is something that one could debate. I mean, this could certainly be a larger issue, but the idea of the aesthetic in relationship to the conceptual or the moral.
How did you like that one?
That is done. Funny you should ask. Now I have another passage. This is lit with strobe lights, and I have time to read one more passage. It's really good. You'll like it. Okay, well. Lynching and summary executions were obviously intended for public viewing. But what did a photograph of a lynching communicate beyond the sunken contortions of a lifeless face or the angle of a broken neck? Photographed, printed, mounted, and sold, such images were frequently embellished with details about the case, usually with a handwritten note across the back, or as in this case, around the edges of the image, which is in the image coming up. The comments usually sought to celebrate the actions of the vigilantes. Most viewers will be drawn to these editorial comments. But the most surprising aspect of this image, oh, I do need to go on to that image. So I'll get to that. That's someone's strobe lights, and then I want to read you my analysis of this 19th century image. So based on that, the impact of the flash, I wanted to, in lynching photographs, I wanted to explore that aspect of the photographs. Here was a, if anybody got a chance to see it, it was at La Cienega recently, just went down. This is a historic anti-lynching button created by the NAACP to raise awareness of lynching. And for those that care for it, I've reproduced a version of it, which you can have at command if you want. This is the actual definition of a lynching. For those that are not sure, there must be legal evidence that a person was killed. That person must have met death illegally. A group of three or more persons must have participated. The group must have acted under the pretext of service to justice, race, or tradition. This is the definition that the Tuskegee Institute and NAACP used to create their list. And by using the same definition to create my list, the hope is that the information, the data, can be combined at some point. Classic example of a vigilance committee from the Wild West. We see people out in daylight, sort of pulling the rope. Here we see a guy in a top hat. Often there's an argument that the best citizens participated, which made it okay. By 1865, it shifts to nighttime. The majority of them are happening in darkness. You can see they're masked here, and it's a drawing from Harper's Bazaar. This is the only historical marker in California, state marker, marking a hangman's tree, which was just inside the bar. The spot where it was, there's a paper mache branch not coming out, which when I was there had a little doll of Osama bin Laden hanging from it. I can skip that. A little bit local, downtown Los Angeles. Five men guy named Wood had stolen a chicken. Basically, they went in and just took everybody that was there. They went in for one guy and just figured, let's save the taxpayers some money. This was the location downtown Los Angeles, the old City Hall. And, that's not working. There's a walking tour of Lynch sites for downtown Los Angeles. If you have friends from out of town, you want to take them on. Well, I think you should, because it's a sort of a history that isn't known, and it's available on my webpage for free, just in print. And you can go. This was right down near the cathedral, and you can see people would take their picnics and go to enjoy the spectacle. This is the site of the Chinese massacre, in which 24 Chinese men were lynched or shot. 14 were actually lynched, hung, and the rest were shot and hung, or stabbed and hung and shot, and various other combinations. And this is the site today, so you can go visit it. There actually is a little plaque on the sidewalk, so you know where you're at if you want to explore that history. It's fascinating to see that this racial history is sort of hidden within Los Angeles, right? Yes?
I'm confused. You were talking about how in Tombstone they constructed a barricade so people couldn't see, and that differentiated the legal execution from a lynching. But then you were talking about how sometimes these postcards were mass-produced in advance of an execution, so that, like you said, in one case, 8,000 people came. Yeah. So which way is it? Was it some executions were public and some weren't, or?
In California, they were all public.
And then the other question I have as part of it is the notion that people actually were packing a picnic to witness a lynching. So was there an aspect of lynching which was, like premeditated and not people running out drunk in the middle of the night and grabbing somebody?
Right. Absolutely, and I argue that in here that it really was premeditated. The idea that it was a spontaneous action isn't possible, because they were often held in jail cells, so you had to have enough. Somebody had to remember to bring the wrench or to bring the screwdriver or whatever it was they needed to get into that jail cell. So it was often premeditated. They would go have the beer or drinks before, and then they'd go after. But they would often have giant poles to ram the door down or something like that. The photographs I was talking about that were mass-produced were of portraits before of the criminals arrested in beautifully dressed suits as studio portraits, and those were sold up to a year ahead of time. So it was a studio portrait. There was no image of the person dying. It was just a portrait of the person sitting there.
Right. And but they were just, when you mentioned that 8,000 figure, that wasn't like people coming to an execution. They were just that many disseminated.
No, that many people coming to the execution.
So there were executions that was a normal practice. Yeah.
That's right. The legal executions were, but the law, state law and federal law, all say that it has to be done in private. It's supposed to not be done for public spectacle.
But it was.
In California, they would often make the claim that there was no, not in every case, but there are some that they did actually do it by the order of the law. But in many cases with these big celebrity bandits, people wanted to see it. And so they would usually make an exception for those and find a situation that would allow it to be seen from rooftops, from hills, from various places where they could still, claim. Like often in Los Angeles, they would happen in the courtyard, but the courtyard walls were very, very low, so it wasn't hard to get a peek at it if you wanted to. Does that answer that question?
Yeah.
Yes?
On the Gold Line Station, Avenue 57 in Highland Park, has as its art treatment a dead tree. And so people call it, in the neighborhood, they think of it as a lynching tree. And that's where Charles Loomis and the Loomis House and Casa de Adobe and all those old historic buildings are. So I was wondering, was this an area, or do you have photographs or in this area of any trees around that area? That was this an area where people used to get lynched? And is that why, or do you think possibly that's why the art treatment at this Avenue 57 Metrorail station is a dead lynching tree?
I don't know that piece, so I don't know the reasons for it. But certainly there were oak trees throughout Los Angeles. There still are some around. And they grew, basically, like sort of the foothills, so any of the hilly areas, like Eagle Rock, all those areas. And there were examples of lynchings in Highland Park and various other places, but the majority of them for Los Angeles took place downtown because, as I said before, the majority of people were held in custody already. They were in the jail downtown. They were not roaming loose in the landscape. They were already incarcerated, and then the community would decide to intervene. Oh. Yes?
Do you cover in your book why people were so drawn to the morbidity of watching these people hang?
Yes.
And also, do you think that if that were to happen today, that there would be, you know, that people would have...
Besides,
same psychology, do you think it still exists?
I mean, look at the Abu Ghraib images and their circulation and how wide that was. And there's many other examples. Part of it also, I mean, everybody slows down when there's a car crash.
Right.
You know, I have a lovely passage that I don't know if all of you can get to, but it's definitely in there, and you'll see what I'm talking about. The idea of the spectacle. I try to get to define this idea of the spectacle instead of just being, it's something that's meant to be seen. I actually walk you through the image and look at the various elements happening in the image in order for us to think about how we perceive that image. So when we're looking at, because part of it is we're looking at images of cadavers, right? This is not something I want to have us do lightly. And so I really try to walk through one way to read them, one way to interpret them, one way to see something new in them that enlightens our understanding of the process and helps us to deal with it. Because I think we also don't want to turn away from the history, right? Just because it is a very abject history. Yeah. Yes.
You were talking about how you shifted the period to 1850,
yeah.
And that makes sense in terms of the end of the U.S.-Mexico War.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a lot of Chicano scholarship about lynchings. I'm thinking of Rudy Acuña, for example. So I'm curious... you're using the term Latino. It's a little more general and depoliticized, and I'm wondering how much in your book do you contextualize this as a part of Chicano history?
I actually go through and break down the entire list. So I break down and identify if people are from different states in the U.S., if they're from different nations. Obviously, a lot of the Anglos were not Americans yet. They were Germans, they were Swiss, there was Italians, there was a little bit of everything. And in terms of the Latinos, I use the general term because of the record keeping of the time, right? They didn't use other words. All they used was Mexican. So Chilean, and derogatory terms, of course. So we're identified by nation, or sometimes they'll say California, which meant Mexican American, as we think of it today. So I break them down exactly. I cite, for example, this case was referred to 4 times as Mexican and 3 times as Chilean. And I just give the data because I can't go back and reconstruct all of that. But as I argue, the majority of them are identified as Mexican, and I believe the majority of them are Mexican, of Mexican origin, not California origin.
If I could just,
Before
I go on with questioning, and I want to stop the discussion, but for those of you who want to buy a book, Lynching in the West, a copy of Lynching in the West, this would be a good time to go to the bookstore and grab a copy and bring it back. And then we'll continue here with discussion. So I just wanted to put that out there so you know time-wise.
As the bookstore is closing. That's fine. Got it, yeah. Question?
Did you find examples of any evidence of people speaking out publicly against lynching in Southern California, both in the press and then...
Absolutely. Usually it was the people in the neighboring counties that were the protest the loudest. So in other words, when it happened in their own county, they'd say, this person was doing this, they had to go. But the next county over will say, those horrible people in L.A., they're just, and vice versa. So you'd find there are lots of cases of that. And typically about 3 weeks later, they would have some sort of scandalous, editorial saying it was scandalous. I did have one, since it's already up, without, I won't read it, but I can just put it on there. It's the, where did she go? Oh, it was the one I passed over. Which basically was the first, there it is. Dame Shirley was an Anglo woman who was living in the gold in the gold region in Northern California. And she actually witnessed a lynching. And so she actually wrote letters to her sister and documented. I also have the the whole affair indeed was a piece of cruel butchery, though that was not intentional, but arose from the ignorance of those who made preparations. In truth, the life was only crushed out of him by hauling the writhing body up and down several times in succession by the rope which was wound round a large bow of his green gallows. So we have a sort of a woman's account, feminist account, and then we have the drawing of the actual same lynching by the man who actually did it, did the rope. He was James Windelier, and he was a German sailor, and he would get called on, because he was a sailor, to tie the knots. So he kept a journal, and they're both sort of able to document, sort of find this moment when we have these two very different reactions. He's saying, yeah, it's cool, it's great, we got this really bad guy, and it was wonderful. Yeah, we had to tug the rope a few times, but, you know, we got the job done. And of course, she's having a very different reaction, and I think that's, from my perspective, it's wonderful in terms of giving a view of the range of views that would have been held at that time, right?
Ken, when was it actually outlawed officially in California?
The first, 1849, about 6 months before we became a state. The first U.S. Constitution guaranteed, California Constitution basically copied the U.S. Constitution, guaranteed right to trial by your peers, guaranteed you didn't have to witness against yourself, so it couldn't be tried twice, for the, you know, all of the same things. And basically I go through and show there are many cases where they, you know, under duress, the person is saying that, yeah, I did it. So they're not really very good convictions. And later, it becomes, once the Constitution becomes a state, the Constitution is implemented. We had the first Supreme Court within 6 months. We had the first judicial courts within 3 months. It was the areas with the most sheriffs and police officers that have the most lynchings.
Wow.
It's not the areas with the least. It's the areas with the most. Right. So it's a very different practice. Yes. Oh, sorry.
You began by describing your project as somewhat based in statistics, and you were going to correct the statistical record to reveal the number of Mexican or Hispanic or Latino, whatever, none of that are involved victims of lynching. And you've acknowledged the guilt of a number of these victims, even while you acknowledge that they are victims of miscarriage of justice. But you've also described the project as a pilgrimage and a memorializing. Can you talk a little about your own experience and what you bring to and take away from the pilgrimage and the memorializing aspect?
Mm-hmm. Well, sort of, you know, as a Mexican-American, of course, I was a little surprised to find out that there was this history that I'd never been told about. And it kind of might be hard to imagine, but sitting there going through hundreds and hundreds of hours reading microfilm, which is a very painful thing to do. If you've never done it, don't do it. Don't do it. I don't recommend it. You're sitting all by yourself in this very, you know, musty library, looking at all of these people and realizing that nobody else knows this, nobody else has seemingly cared about this history, and finding it has no voice. That parallels certain experiences one might have as a Latino from any number of communities. You know, we all might identify our layers of difference and have different moments where we feel them, whether it's as women, whether it's as men, whether it's whatever. So part of it was finding this thing that I was like, oh my goodness, you know, there's just this amazing history here. I felt connected to it on some level, culturally. And as I unraveled the details and found more and more cases where it really was, as I read in the book, they actually constructed the idea of the greaser, or the Mexican, was a construction. It's one of the first creations California gives to the world, is this sort of, because there already was global bias against, you know, in Europe, against Asians, against Africans, against various other peoples, but they didn't really know what a Latino was yet, whether that was Mexican or Latin American. And so I go through and trace some of that formation as well, and I trace it through in the cases of the lynchings as well, how they're described, where is race invoked, where is difference invoked, how did that contribute to the case. I show overall that the data part, because I also have to create a list of legal executions for the first 50 years, because there is no record anywhere except for this book. of the first 100 cases, and I break down the data there, and it shows roughly 20% are Latino. If you go to the lynching statistics, it breaks down to roughly 35%. So the point there is to say that using straightforward data, I can say that there is a prevalence of lynching this community over and above the legal executions. And in fact, oftentimes, they would be taken out of the legal system precisely for that reason. They might get a life sentence instead of a death penalty, and so the community might decide that that was not acceptable. So I really am trying to talk about that there was an impact on difference on this history. And though we do have cases of white on white, we have cases of white on brown, brown on white, Asian on Latinos, all kinds of combinations. So it also is to, I don't want to make it sound monolithic either. There's lots of subtleties there in each different case, and I really try to get into that a little bit. But for me personally, the part I was responding to was just the numbers of Latino dead, and I wanted to go. I had to go. One day I just started hopping in the car. I'm like, I have to go see this spot. It's right over there. I got to go look for it. And then I started photographing it. So, yes, back there.
I would like to know just two quick questions. First of all, if you're not able to purchase the book today, will it be in the bookstore, or is there another place that I will be able to purchase it? And how much is the book?
It's cheap. It's a bargain. I don't know how much it is in the bookstore, but it's well worth it. You figure that's per hour, that's about, one penny a day.
I'm just saying, okay. Well, it will be available.
It's in the bookstore. It's also at Duke University Press. And
many local bookstores carry the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's available.
Okay, and one more question. This is the last one. I find it kind of interesting that, as far as how you talk about the categorization of, for example, the indigenous inhabitants of the area, like the West, so to speak, Arizona, California. As far as, is there any statistics on, like did the Mexican American or Mexican people look the same way then as they do now? And because like when I turn on the Spanish news media, they look a lot more Anglo, or they're in between. If you look at a lot of places in Mexico, the people have a lot more indigenous, aboriginal features, or they fall somewhere close in between. Like yourself, if you put you next to somebody that has Nordic features, you're a lot darker than they are.
It was equally as varied as it is now. There was definitely a tendency to, a number of the cases are specifically identified as being very dark skinned and being identified as mestizo very often, meaning that they had a fair amount of, a recognizable amount of indigenous bloodlines. So I think overall, we also had class issues, which we did not have time to talk about, but in Los Angeles there were sort of ruling class families of Mexican and Mexican American descent. And so we have a whole range
with a higher percentage of the population that was categorized as Mexican or Indian had more indigenous aboriginal features than, let's say, the general percentage of population that would be categorized as Mexican today?
I don't know the answer to that because I don't have, I wouldn't think, that's an interesting question, but I don't know the answer to that. I don't have photographs of all of the communities. I don't know what they all look like. A lot of times I'm going based on the description in the newspaper trying to imagine, trying to maybe even figure out if they were California or if they were Mexican national.
At this point, I'd like to thank Ken for being here. We invite people to come forward. You can keep asking questions if you'd like, and we can start the book signing.
Oh, I see, yeah. We're transitioning. That's right, we're transitioning. So I would still be here. Yeah, keep asking, and if anybody comes back with a book, they may have just gone to their cars. Yes, go ahead.
Mike, I was going to have a question. You mentioned that there was the last lynching in the United States in 1968.
Not in California, but the last recorded lynching in the NAACP list is 1968.
Now, did they do an investigation and have a trial on the perpetrators of that lynching?
That particular case, I don't know, but in general, I can tell you for California, there are, and nationwide, there were many trials and nobody ever gets prosecuted.
Are there any, like, of the cold cases that people are trying to get the U.S. government to investigate involved lynching?
There were cases that they would go through it for a little while and then they just would throw it out. So nothing ever, in California, there were no prosecutions. There were about a half dozen trials and no prosecutions at all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, no, 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 no.